from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the psychic madman Jim Carroll joins us. Here's what's happening. Well, if you're a pet owner, specifically a dog owner, listen to this one. A dangerous, very dangerous new strain of dog flu is spreading concern right now across the West. A dog in Montana recently tested positive for a highly contagious virus, and the state of Washington Health Department is warning pet owners after possible exposure at a Seattle area kennel there. Now, in Chicago, the dog flu spread so quickly last year that some shelters were forced to close their doors to prevent contamination. They are recommending that if your animal comes down with any of this, take them immediately to the vet. Hurricane Alex forming in the Atlantic Ocean. It's the first hurricane to form in January since 1938. A hurricane warning was issued for the Azores, the islands roughly 900 miles west of Portugal. Forecasters said the hurricane's maximum sustained winds right now around 85 miles an hour. Not that big, but it could get bigger. Hey, grab a dollar out of your wallet, out of your pocket, out of your purse. Take a look at it. It says, "In God we trust," right? Well, a new lawsuit filed on behalf of several atheist plaintiffs argues that the phrase, "In God we trust," on U.S. money is unconstitutional and calls for the government to simply get rid of it. Sacramento attorney Michael Newdow filed a lawsuit in Akron, Ohio. He unsuccessfully sued the government at least twice, challenging the use of the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. As we reported last night while we were on the air, attackers set off a series of explosions in a bustling shopping area of Indonesia's capital city of Jakarta in what authorities said was an imitation of last November's terror attacks in Paris that killed 130 people. The Islamic State, of course, taking credit for this. 19 people injured, all five attackers, and a Canadian and Indonesian died in those morning explosions. U.S. markets bouncing back, and Asian stocks won a temporary reprieve after oil prices snapped their eight-day rout. They were plunging and plunging away, helping to lift a battered energy shares, even as investors, though, remain on the edge as they looked for signs of some stability in China's economy and its volatile markets. Michael Mish Shedlock, our registered investment advisor, with us. Mish, tell me, why is China so important to our economy? Because they hold so much debt?
Well, it's the global economy, not because of the debt. Actually, you know, we can blame it started with China. They had to slow down. They were overbuilding housing, overbuilding railroad stations, overbuilding trains, airports. All of this stuff went unused. They actually demolished a building the other day, less than a year old, you know, because it was already unusable, unlivable. They've got entire cities where no one lives. So we've got so they stopped buying all this copper, they stopped buying all the coal, the concrete. It hit Canada, which is our neighbor to the north, our largest trading partner. It hit Australia, it hit the emerging markets, it's hitting Europe. And we had an interesting admission yesterday. I was on before last week, and I talked about we had an admission from a Fed governor. We had another one yesterday. San Francisco Fed governor was talking about oil prices, and someone asked him a question 2 days ago at the end of the conference, and he was actually pretty blunt. He said, "You know what? We've got this wrong. You know, maybe this fall in oil prices isn't as good as we thought it was. We thought consumers would go out and spend." All the things we've talked about here, George, Fed admitted 2 days ago.
And they're not spending that much, are they?
No, they're not. Why? Because rent prices are going up. So, you know, they think people are going to spend the gas money. Well, actually they did, but not on shopping, not on the things that the Fed expected them to spend it on. They're spending it on rent. They're spending it on education. They're spending it on health care. Healthcare costs. The emails, George, I'm getting, you have to be getting the same ones about healthcare costs going up. That's where the money's going. So it's not that they're not spending it. They really don't have it.
Well, that's a good point, Mish. Thank you. And nearly a century ago, historian Sidney Perley identified the place in Salem, Massachusetts, where 19 accused witches met their end in 1692. Now finally some confirmation. The Salem News reports that the seven scholars who composed the Gallows Hill Project have, after a five-year effort, definitively determined that Proctor's Ledge was where the executions did take place. A Spanish court has sent a farmer to prison after he cut off his hand and faked a car wreck for insurance money. The investigators say that the farmer had run short on cash in 2007 when he concocted the plan. He started by hacking off his right hand and quickly applying a tourniquet to stop the bleeding. Then court documents show that he deliberately drove his car off the road into an orange grove, tossed his hand inside the car, and lit the vehicle on fire. He called emergency services, but when the cops and firefighters arrived, he was there smoking a cigar. The farmer ultimately tried pocketing more than $2 million from a total of eight insurance companies. It didn't work. A great actor, Alan Rickman, known for films including Harry Potter, Die Hard, and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, has died at the age of 69. He had been suffering from cancer. I will always remember him as Hans Gruber in Die Hard. He played a great part. And, you know, our buddy Robert Davi played an FBI agent in that movie as well. A 10-year, $4 billion proposal to bring self-driving cars to roads across the United States has now been announced by the Department of Transport. The plan's stated aim is to implement consistent laws across all the states and eventually eliminate human error. Boy, that's going to be something if that happens. An eye-popping and unprecedented Powerball jackpot, $1.6 billion, three winners, Florida, Tennessee, and California. Now here's Peter Davenport with his weekly report of what's going on in the skies. Peter, what do you got?
Boy, there's a lot going on, George, and God help us if we ever have self-driving cars. What could possibly
happen? It's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, if anything, the reports are getting more and more interesting, and I've got some really interesting ones tonight. You remember when President Reagan, I think he was before the United Nations, was conjecturing what would happen if we were threatened, if the planet were threatened from outside, how people would draw together. Well, that leads me to my first report tonight. We got a beautiful report from a former Special Forces instructor who was working at Camp McCall, which is about 30 miles southwest of Fort Bragg, he says, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He reports that on the 13th of September of 2010, he was out in the field training a group of Special Forces cadets or trainees, candidates, I think he calls them. They were on a night ambush setting, and he and his co-instructor became aware of a very loud sound behind them. They wheeled around. They could quickly determine that it was jet fighters approaching their location, which alarmed them a little bit. They activated their night vision devices. He calls them the PVS-14 model, and he couldn't have been more amazed by what he saw, he reports, with his night vision devices. A huge, huge black triangular craft with lights, blue lights in the corners. He said he's never seen anything like it. His instructor, co-instructor, assistant instructor, I guess he labels him, had the same reaction. The object went to the north, and the two of them were standing there conjecturing on what it was they'd seen when back it comes from the north, now being pursued by three F-15s. They think they were F-15s. They could see the exhaust. Very, very interesting report, and if anybody would like to see a very interesting illustration, it's posted on the homepage of our website, ufocenter.com. We're hoping to get a report from the assistant instructor as well, who is every bit as shocked as the gentleman who submitted the report. 9 days ago, different report, Las Vegas, a former law enforcement officer was driving south in Centennial Hills, looked off to his left. He was driving on Interstate 40, 95, I guess, 95 freeway, looked off to his left, and above one of the casinos, he too saw a triangular craft. He almost drove off the highway, he says. Very interesting report, and we're going to try to get an illustration from this individual as well.
Okay.
Guy was, he says, he dealt with a lot of loonies in Las Vegas trying to report UFOs, and indeed there are a lot of such people, but he said, this is not a report from that type of person. Very nicely written report. Last night, Mommel, Arkansas, which is on the west side of Little Rock, I believe, gentleman was driving on Interstate 40, driving west. He saw a couple very large lights coming at him from the west, I think. He couldn't determine what they were. Suddenly realized they were descending and accelerating. They went over the highway in front of him. That's when he could see a line of silver lights running through the middle of both of them. Very interesting report. I encourage people to read it. We hope to have an illustration from this gentleman very soon posted to our website. We just received it just minutes before the program tonight. And finally, last report from tonight, Dayton, Tennessee. Woman was driving on the highway. Her attention was drawn to a very bright light off to the left of her car. She saw, she reports, a cigar-shaped blue or blue-green object streaking across the night sky. We're going to try to get an illustration from her. But in summary, there's a lot going on, and I've never seen so many interesting reports in such a short period of time. I'm urging people to keep their eyes and ears open.
All right, Peter, thanks. And Peter's website, of course, ufocenter.com. Up next, it's called The Fight, a Secret Service agent's inside account of security failings and the political machine. Dan Bongino joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dan Bongino is a former member of both the New York City Police Department and the U.S. Secret Service. He served in the Secret Service during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. He's the author of Life Inside the Bubble and his new book that we're talking about tonight called The Fight. He's a contributing editor at Conservative Review. Fills in for some national talk shows, too, our friends Sean Hannity. He ran for the Senate and the Congress. And, Dan, you almost won that congressional seat. That one was close.
Oh, that was tough. We actually did win on Election Day. We lost on the absentee count 5 days later.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
My gosh.
I'm still getting over that one.
Are you ever going to run again?
You know, I'm thinking about it. I'm looking at potentially running in this cycle. It's a strong possibility, we'll say. I hate to give you the political answer, but I really don't know. It's up to my wife. She's the most important voice of this whole debate.
My gosh. Did you know many Secret Service agents who were stationed in St. Louis 10 years ago, by any chance?
Yeah, I knew a few. Yeah, a couple of them. Not that big of an office.
We were friends with one. I won't give his last name, but he passed away. Died of a heart attack. His name was Chuck. I don't know if you knew him or not.
By the time we're done with the show, I'll probably take
His main responsibility was counterfeiting. And
that's the St. Louis office, unfortunately, is busy with that type of financial crime activity. But yeah, smaller office.
How'd you get involved in that?
You know, I really, shockingly, had zero interest in the Secret Service. I was a graduate student at the City University of New York, studying neuropsychology and behavioral learning. And I wanted to be an FBI profiler. I had read the book, Mindhunter. It's a pretty popular book. It's been out forever about how it works. And I found it just fascinating how the Bureau, these FBI profilers, could put together these incredibly detailed profiles of these criminals just based on a crime scene, no knowledge of who the criminal was whatsoever. And that's all I wanted to do. And it was my father, actually, who came downstairs one day. I was in my aunt's basement, actually. I was doing some painting. And he gave me a pamphlet for the Secret Service and said, I really think you need to check this out. This sounds fascinating. And that the rest, as they say, is history. I went for the interview, and they just really sold me on the job. The interviewer just, he was an incredible recruiter for the Secret Service, describing what they did. And I never looked back.
Well, I've got to tell you, and I've got to thank you, one, for your service as a police officer and with the Secret Service, because in many cases, and we've seen some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight, they're thankless jobs, aren't they?
Oh, gosh. There are some days, the Secret Service, I used to joke, it's like the closest thing to being famous without anybody knowing who you are and none of the perks. I mean, you're traveling around the world, you're constantly getting sick. I mean, there are times people like to, engage in hyperbole and say things like, I travel around, sometimes I don't even know what city I'm in. I'm telling you, in the Secret Service, that actually happens, that you'll wake up sometimes and you're like, wait, what country am I even in? Like, you have to think about it for a second, and then it all fits together. So yeah, it can be a thankless job, but there are times I miss it, though. It is really exciting. I actually highly recommend it for young kids out there who want to jump into federal law enforcement. I think it's the best of all the jobs.
Oh, not easy, though. My God, you're constantly watching and low. And we'll get into things like ISIS and stuff like that, and the protection of the president and the White House. I've got to ask you this, because since Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, I've been obsessed with this story. And there's a piece of video that's been on YouTube. I've watched it 25 times. It's got the Secret Service near the limousine, kind of jogging along while the president's limo was moving ahead. And he's clearly, the Secret Service agent clearly has been told to stand down. And he throws his hands up in the air like, what are you talking about? And that was right before the shootings occurred. Have you ever seen that piece of video?
I must have at some point. We were in training. You see that film so many times from so many different perspectives and so many different people talking about it. Yeah, I probably have, but it's been a while. I mean, training for me was in 1999. But yeah, still a lot of people, you're not the only one, George. There are a lot of people who still feel like there are a lot of unanswered questions with that. And I understand where it comes from. We haven't exactly had the greatest history in the United States of putting information out there, but it should be. So I get why people would have a lot of questions.
Within the Secret Service, did you folks talk a lot about the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale that's plastered into everybody's brain. I think the reason they bring it up so much in training, first is the obvious. It was a catastrophic failure, and I don't think that's melodramatic at all. It's true. And secondly, I think it's meant to tell the young agents that, hey, guys and ladies, this is the cost of your failure. You blow it, you are looking at a global, international crisis that you potentially caused. You can't blow this. This is a zero-error environment. The one thing about the Secret Service that I always admired is they have this ability to pull the best out of people. I mean, really get every ounce. And even big companies, great companies like IBM and Microsoft, even sometimes they have a problem doing things like that. And you'd think a government agency... And, that's kind of why in the book, too, I know it's easy to take a shot at the Secret Service. They've been through a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows the scandals. They're unfortunately famous. But, George, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, President Obama is one of the most threatened men in the history of the planet, and he hasn't had as much as a hangnail in office. I mean, they have to be doing something right. And I try to explain a little bit of that in the book to give them a little bit of credit.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, my gosh, what a job to have to protect the president and other dignitaries on a regular basis. How many Secret Service members are there nationwide?
Yeah, right now there's about 4,000. When I got in, it was 3,000. It fluctuates, sadly, now because of a retention problem. Attrition is high. Yeah, and I'll tell you, George, when I came on, that was unheard of. I mean, literally, and I'm not kidding, like you either died or you retired, and no one left. It was unheard of. It just has gone downhill since the transfer from the Department of Treasury, Department of Homeland Security. There's been a lot of mismanagement. Obviously, the scandals have taken a really heavy, almost like apocalyptic toll on the Secret Service's collective morale. And I'm hearing stories now, even still, I've been out 3 years, of friends of mine who are leaving from the protective details. Leaving alone was unheard of. Leaving from the protective detail of the president, the greatest honor in the Secret Service, and walking in the office and resigning, that was the kind of thing where you would think someone was joking. Like, and it wouldn't have even been a funny joke because it was so unbelievable. You know, oh, yeah, gee, you know, whatever. Johnny left the president's detail. He resigned yesterday. Jeez. Yeah, it's funny. No, no, I'm serious. And it's really crazy.
All right, Dan, stay with us. Going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. Our special guest, Dan Bongino, he is a former Secret Service agent. He's a bestseller. His first book, of course, hit the charts, Life Inside the Bubble. This one is called The Fight, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, Dan Bongino, we're talking about his work, The Fight, former Secret Service agent. And, of course, we'll be back with him in a moment. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Dan Bongino with us, his work, The Fight. Dan, I've been to the White House a couple times years ago, invited there for lunch with President Reagan when he invited a number of television news directors, of which I was one, and, you know, he was about 200 feet away from me where he was. But the thing that really kind of puzzled me about the White House was how vulnerable it looked from the outside in terms of there weren't a lot of security. It didn't look like there was. What kind of, was that a perception, or I don't want to give away any trade secrets here.
No. Yes, it is a perception, but it's designed to be a perception, if that makes sense. Couple of things first. The White House was never built for security. I mean, obviously, you know, it was built in the era of Adams and Washington.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It wasn't designed for, you know, EMP type attacks, seven triple sevens to fly into it. It wasn't designed for any of that. It was designed to be a home. I mean, back in those days, the definition of a lobbyist was someone who could walk into the lobby of the White House or a government building and actually speak to people. None of that, of course, happens now. There have been significant upgrades, but I'll say this about the White House. Very, very little of what you see, George, in the White House is what it appears. I mean, outside of the obvious, you know, a picture is a picture, but there are a lot of built-in security measures to the White House and surprises that when you become a Secret Service agent, you're like, oh, that does that? That's interesting. You know, it was fascinating when you got on the president's detail to see all the stuff they managed to do to upgrade it.
Yet, when you see these stories of people jumping the fence, drones crashing in the yard, how does that happen?
Yeah, that fence story. You know, I was running for Congress at the time, and I'm sitting in my house, and it was a late night. I'd just gotten back, and I get a tweet from a CNN producer who tweets to me directly, says, hey, can you come on the show tomorrow to discuss this fence jumping incident? And as I got the details, I thought, this has got to be a joke. There is no way this person made it over the fence, and we didn't know at the time into the White House, but as far as we did know, he made it at least onto the porch. I thought, this can't possibly be right. You know, George, I'm pretty obviously intimately familiar with the security operation and the infrastructure there at the White House. It is such a detailed, multi-layered plan. When I first heard the story, I thought, this can't possibly be true. Matter of fact, I didn't even get back to her because I wanted to be sure it wasn't a joke. You know what happened there, and I said this early, I called and wish I hadn't. I said it had to be human error because the technology, you know, the choke point in the technology are human beings, which, as you probably figured out a long time ago, George, is typically always the case.
That's right.
And I was right. I said, I'll bet there was someone on a cell phone that didn't see something and failed to do something and then failed to let the dog loose because the dog is the ultimate fail-safe. They have the dog on the lawn that's designed to knock we have Belgian Malinois that are muzzled. And when they hit you and you jump the fence and they attack and knock you down, it's like getting hit by a truck. And I thought there's no way it didn't happen unless he failed to release the dog. And it turned out later on that I was right. That's what happened. I mean, the technology worked fine. It was the human error that really screwed everything up.
What happened to him?
Yeah, he's in a little bit of hot water.
I mean,
obviously, that's the kind of thing you know, we're in a zero-error environment in the Secret Services. No room for excuses. There's no do-overs. If the president was walking around on the state floor
when
Stalin got in there, yeah, it would have been catastrophic. You know, but one thing about that, George, a lot of people out there don't understand the distinction between the uniformed division and the agents of the Secret Services. This isn't meant to, you know, to throw any blame off of, but it's just a fact. The agents had nothing to do with that. The Secret Service agents had long since left the White House. The president flew out about 15 minutes earlier to Camp David. The agents protect the body. They don't protect the White House. The uniform division does that. We follow the breathing president of the United States. We don't follow buildings around.
That's right.
So that was the uniform division. That wasn't the agent side of the house.
I'm told Kennedy, when they would go to New York, for example, would sneak out on his own and go into Greenwich Village, hit some bars, and would be by himself. Have you heard that? Was that true?
You know, I have heard stories like that about Kennedy from guys, let's just say guys who knew guys, because I came in under Clinton.
Yeah.
But is it possible? Not now. No, now it's not. There's no way the President of the United States or even the First Lady could sneak out without us knowing. I mean, someone in the Secret Service would have to be a part of it. You know, with that famous picture where Michelle Obama went to shop at Target. Do you remember that? That was planned by the Secret Service. I mean, there were some agents who didn't know. I'll give you a quick example of this, right? One day I'm working, and I'm up on the third floor of the White House, and they tell me the president's in the gym. So I don't hear anything. I don't hear any grunting or groaning. And typically, you know, when they work out, you get the typical, the people work out, they make these funny sounds. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's really weird. What's he doing in there? So I'm sitting up there for about 20 minutes, and Laura Bush walks by. She looks at me. She stops. She looks again. She says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean? What am I doing? In my head, I'm thinking I'm Secret Servicing. This is what we do. We protect the president, right?" She goes, "He's not here." So I'm thinking to myself, "Did I miss him?" Well, I walked downstairs, and sure enough, the president had taken a trip to Iraq and had left 8 hours earlier. And to keep the disguise up, they didn't even tell the working agents.
Wow.
So I said to my boss, I'm like, "Hey, thanks a lot. You couldn't have told me that. Exactly. I look like an idiot up there on the third floor." He's like, "Hey, you know, it's called the Secret Service for a reason, you know."
What would you have done if you were assigned to watch the president and he came up to you and insisted and said, "Dan, I am going out by myself. I'm in a car. I've got a little whatever, and I'm going out by myself." I mean, are you compelled to tell him no, or what happens?
That happened to me, not with the President of the United States, but with another protector. The answer is, yeah, no, you're not going out by yourself, no matter what. And I know that sound. I know a lot of your listeners have to be listening right now, thinking that's crazy. If the president says it, he's the President of the United States. But no, there are red lines that aren't crossed, and he doesn't get to say that. The president, here's an interesting tidbit of information for your audience. The president is the one protectee the Secret Service has but he is a protectee, let's say, who cannot sign off on his own protection. There are foreign leaders, there are other protectees down the line who they can actually sign a form and say, "I don't want protection anymore." Matter of fact, it happens a lot. We call it a sign-off. You know, they sign off, and foreign leaders do it all the time at the UN. The president cannot do that. He has no. He can't sign off his own protection. He would have to rewrite the law and sign a bill to get rid of his own protective detail. But yeah, it actually happened to me one time where a protectee lower down on the protection scale tried to get away from me. We actually got into a little shoving match outside of an elevator to the humor of a lot of other agents who were watching. I said, "No, you're not going." "No," she said, "I'm going by myself." I said, "No, you're not." We got into an actual shoving match.
If the president said, "Look, I'm going to Iran. I'm going to cut a deal, and this stuff is nonsense. I'm fixing this problem. I'm going." Now, does he go with a number of Secret Service agents, and how protected is he really in a different country like that?
Yeah, I did 3 foreign lead advances where I was the big dog on that trip. You're running the operation, and those are tough because do you remember the situation with the sign language interpreter at the Mandela funeral?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a disaster. You know, I did a lot of media on that, and I was trying to explain to people, having done multiple foreign lead advances here, that you're really relying heavily on the competency and the word of the foreign government. You know, George, the Secret Service, we're not law enforcement officers in South Africa or Iran, or I did advances in Indonesia, I did advances in Prague, in Afghanistan, in an active war zone. I did President Obama's, I was the lead advance for that trip. You're not a law enforcement officer, you're a guest of the country. They extend us diplomatic courtesies, they allow us to carry weapons, but that's them allowing it. It's not that we have any arrest powers or anything. So you're really relying on the local host government. And as we saw with the South Africans, with the Mandela funeral, it's not that they're not competent. They were just overwhelmed. And there was really little the Secret Service could do, George. If you go to Iran and the Iranians on the ground, their secret police or whatever it is, they tell you that, hey, this group of people we're allowing in the room with the president has been vetted and they're safe. What are you going to do? You can't go to the local DMV in Iran.
Yeah, you're stuck.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
you're stuck is right. That's it.
I was in Mexico several years ago, almost got kidnapped. It became a national story. And you are really helpless in another country. I happen to be a concealed weapons holder, Dan, but I'm not carrying in Mexico. And you're really, you know, at a disadvantage. And, you know, you don't know.
We had situations in even in really, you know, now I'm not talking about the third world here. I'm thinking of a situation in Argentina. We were down there with Jenna Bush. And late at night, this call came over the radio. One of the agents who was sitting outside an apartment she rented, he starts screaming over the radio. This guy starts stabbing his girlfriend right in front of the. Yeah, we couldn't believe it. And what he didn't. What was he going to do? You can't get out of the car and start shooting at the guy. So we called the local police. Took him forever to respond. But yeah, you're really at the mercy of a lot of these foreign governments. And you know, we saw it with the sign language thing. And even in Afghanistan, I mean, I was completely at the mercy of thankfully the United States military, which did a competent, more than competent job. But they were the ones who gave us all the intelligence and fed us the information on who was, okay, this person's good, this person's no good. But you're trusting them completely. And luckily, they did a good job. But not, you know, in some countries, that's not the case.
How did the sign language guy even get in?
Yeah, this is a perfect example of why I cover this at length in the book. I have a chapter on the Charlie Hebdo rally that the president never made it to and what I think happened there. And I talk about the sign language incident and what I'm sure happened and how it went wrong. And what I think the problem is, George, is when the president says, I'm going somewhere, you know, you're going. I'm telling you, you're going. You brought up Iran. I'm telling you right now, if the president said we're taking a trip to Iran, the Secret Service, under no uncertain terms, would say, listen, this is a really, really bad idea. This is a terrible idea. But the pressure from the presidency, the office of the presidency, on the Secret Service to make it happen is typically, you know, overwhelming. And I think what happened at the Mandela funeral is I know the lead advance agent probably said this is a disaster. The logistics are terrible. They're not vetting people. And the White House said, and it happens in administrations of all, you know, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. They probably said, listen, the president, it'll look bad if he doesn't go. He's going. So just make it happen. And I think everybody just kept their fingers crossed. And, you know, luck just didn't pan out in the sign language incident. The South Africans told us the guy was okay. And we took them at their word. But I'm pretty sure they knew that the vetting process was flawed at best.
And I'm not even sure he was a sign languager. I think he faked the whole thing, didn't he?
Professional sign language, people who understand sign language and can sign, said that no, there was not a sign at all. Like no one could, there was nothing there, George. It would be like you making up baby talk and saying
he,
Spanish.
He was like a baseball catcher giving a pitcher signals.
Right, curveball.
Yeah,
slider,
this, that.
Ball.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
It was,
I wonder what happened to him. Did he get arrested?
Yeah, he was questioned. I'm not sure what happened with him with the South Africans later on. I know he got in a little bit of, I mean, he was subjected to a number of different interviews. I don't think he was deemed to be a threat, despite, sadly, a criminal history that enabled to get
right.
That.
But he could have been. Circle. My God.
Oh, no question.
Had he had a knife, he could have stabbed the president. Nobody could have stopped him.
I mean, you know, George, even little, I mean, he could have punched him in the face when he wasn't looking and knocked him out. I mean, either way,
tackled
he
him.
Lose,
yeah.
You know? So,
absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the three presidents that you worked with, beginning with Bill Clinton. Did you like the guy?
You know, I did, and I ran for office as a conservatarian, you know, a liberty-loving conservative. He had this ability. It was and you can ask any Secret Service agent off the record. They'll tell you the same thing. I used to joke and say that the guy sweats charisma. I mean, it was unbelievable. It's like his sweat had some kind of a magic quality to it. Like he'd walk in a room. It used to happen all the time. And it always, you know, there'd inevitably be some Republicans in there. You know, you go to New York and it's a mixed crew of people in a room and it's a mix and mingle. And, you know, you'd hear them beforehand and they'd say, like, you know, I, this guy, that Clinton or whatever. And then he'd leave and I'd hear them say, you know, I'd never vote for the guy, but I get it. You know, I get it. Like, he had this magical ability to make you feel like you were the only person in the room, even with the agents. I mean, I'll tell you a quick story. They had a Secret Service Christmas party once for the New York field office. Small party, but it was nice, and, you know, the family, it wasn't a big deal. And he was in a car, this is how I heard it. He was in a car with the agents and overheard one of the agents talking about this party and said, you know, hey, you know, I'd like to stop by in my terrible Bill Clinton voice. He stopped by this Christmas party and stayed for like 2 hours, took pictures with every single person there. So, you know, the agents, I think, are largely conservative in their politics. But, you know, they loved him. I mean, the guy had a pretty magical ability to relate to people that I think not all presidents have.
I'm a friend of Prince Albert of Monaco and dear friends with one of his very close friends. And they would fly from the United States to Monaco in a jet owned by a fellow by the name of Michael Smurfit, who owned a pretty big company. He's an Irish businessman. And Bill Clinton would fly with them every once in a while. And, I mean, they all loved him. They thought he was the coolest guy. And this was when he was not the president anymore. But, thought he was...
Yeah, when you put the politics aside, you move away from the politics. I get the question a lot. He really did have... I mean, what are the French? The French called, you know, the je ne sais quoi, right? Yeah. No one really can explain what it is, or you'd bottle it and sell it, and you'd be a multimillionaire. But he definitely had it. People loved him and gravitated towards him.
He loved the ladies. They told me he did love the ladies.
Downfall. Yeah, a little too much.
And ironically, he might get back in the White House indirectly.
Yeah, I think they're in a lot more trouble, and that's, I think, the issue. I think she doesn't have the political skills. She may have the following, but doesn't have the political skills he did. I mean, he had an unquestioned ability to be able to, he was like the Teflon Don.
Yeah.
I mean, everything just bounced off, but things tend to stick, I think, a little more with the missus. She may be in a little bit of trouble.
What do you think of the candidates to date?
Yeah, listen, on the Republican side, I think they've got their dream team. I mean, you've got different lanes. You've got an establishment lane full of credible people. You got Rubio, you got Christie, you got Jeb Bush. I mean, think about it. The guy running last in that lane right now, Jeb Bush, was a two-term, more than successful governor of Florida. Even most moderate Democrats, I think, would agree with that assessment. You know, you've got people I guess you could call Tea Party favorites, if that label's appropriate. You got with Cruz. You have a media mogul in Trump who, if you dislike the media, which a lot of conservatives don't, I mean, he's your dream candidate. On the left, you know, you got Mrs. Clinton, who I think they feel is her turn. And if you happen to have a more left-type leaning politics and you're a Democratic socialist, you've got your guy. So I think it's going to be an interesting race. I think it's going to be tough, though, for the Democrats to hold on. I think the numbers bear that out historically, though. It's very tough for a party to hold three terms. The last time it's happened is in the last, 30 years or so. I was looking at a report the other day. It was George H.W. Bush after Reagan, and, you know, that didn't turn out so well for him long term either, with Clinton winning that next election.
And George Bush the son, what'd you think of him?
Yeah, he was great to the. He really liked the agents. And one thing that always stuck out with George W. is he had this unbelievable love for military and cops. He would do this thing, George, where at every stop we would do with Air Force One, under the wing of Air Force One would be the Gold Star families, which were parents, typically mothers who had lost some hero in combat, their son or their daughter, and every stop. And it would add, I mean, if you had four or five stops a day, he would spend, you know, sometimes 15 minutes with these families. You know, it would really prolong the day for him. But he did it because that's absolutely, it was every stop.
He never got credit for that either, Dan.
No, he never did. Yeah. It was touching. I mean, I was always glad I had glasses on when it happened because, you know, you'd get welled up. I mean, it was not fake emotion.
No.
He wasn't doing it for the press.
Let's talk about President Obama, what you think of him, and a few other things, and we'll take some phone calls. Final hour to go with our special guest, Dan Bongino. His book, The Fight.